Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York invites you to Be the Informed Patient with the podcast that features experts from Central New York's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Amber Smith. It's important to be aware that some traditionally tropical diseases are being transmitted in the United States. Today, we'll talk about the Zika and dengue viruses with Dr. Stephen Thomas. He's professor and chair of microbiology and immunology at Upstate, and also the director of the Upstate Global Health Institute. Welcome back to The Informed Patient, Dr. Thomas.
Thank you, Amber. It's great to be back.
Listeners may remember hearing from you frequently during the COVID pandemic, but you've worked extensively on vaccine development for other viruses, including Ebola and Zika. And before you came to Upstate, you spent 20 years in the U.S. Army Medical Corps at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. Before we get into the dengue virus, let me ask you where things stand with a vaccine for Zika. And can you first remind us what the Zika virus is?
Sure. The dengue viruses and Zika virus are in the same family. So they're called flaviviruses, and yellow fever is in that family, and West Nile virus, which we've had a history of in New York, is also in that family, as is Japanese encephalitis virus. And so, as you mentioned, most of these are located in tropical and subtropical climates. They're transmitted by mosquitoes. So Zika is transmitted by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, and that's the primary mosquito that transmits dengue viruses. Most people who get infected with Zika, they don't know it, like a lot of viruses. People get infected and they either don't get sick at all or they get so mildly ill that it doesn't really interrupt their lives in any way. But then there can be a percentage of people that they get infected and they do get sick. They get fever and headache and muscle pain, and they get fatigue. They can have a rash, or they can get these kind of red inflamed eyes, bloodshot eyes. In a very small percentage of people, they can have some pretty significant neurologic problems that can result from infection. And this is one of the first signals that we saw back in the outbreaks in Latin America back in 2015, 2016. They can get something called Guillain-Barré, which can be fatal. It can prevent you from being able to breathe on your own. But the real public health burden of Zika were the infections that occurred in pregnant women who they might not have become ill, but there was a relatively high rate of the fetus becoming infected and significantly damaged with, it's a syndrome. So you can have multiple different types of findings, but they called it congenital Zika syndrome, one of which was microcephaly. And people may remember seeing these pictures of children from Brazil with very, very small heads and deformed heads, and of course, brains that had significant problems as a result. So that's Zika, and that's why it's really so important to us.
We still don't have a vaccine, right, for Zika?
You are correct. So like many things, when there's a problem and it's right in your face, and when there's a fire going on, everyone scrambles and everyone starts looking for water and sand and things of that nature. And then when the raging fire becomes a small little thing, they all forget and move on to the next problem. The global scientific community and the global medical countermeasure development community, they were all rallied at one point when this was all going on. I was still in the Department of Defense at that time, and we were very concerned because we have service members who deploy or are stationed all over the tropical and subtropical world, to include tens of thousands of women of childbearing age. And so we were very concerned and wanted to try to develop a vaccine, as did the US NIH, as did a number of pharmaceutical companies. And we advanced very fast, and we went very fast and got into human testing quickly. And it was because we had a lot of experience, similar experience with other viruses that were like Zika, and we had technologies that were on the shelf that we could pull off those playbooks and modify them to meet the Zika need. But when things started to calm down and the problems started to dissipate, then attentions went to other problems and resources dried up and things kind of paused.
So is the work still being done to help pregnant women?
We had, down in Brazil in particular, thousands of children born to infected mothers and thousands of children who were affected, either in very severe ways, like the way I mentioned, where it's clearly obvious, microcephaly is clearly obvious, but also in ways that were not obvious at the time of birth, but that have become obvious over time as the children have grown. And so kids having significant neurologic problems or psychological problems, or they're having behavioral disorders or developmental delays or other issues that are not evident at the time, but they become evident over time. And so the public health burden of Zika still very much exists in places that had large outbreaks. So they're still contending with that, with the issues from 2015, almost 10 years ago. There is still clearly in places where Zika is possible, there's educational campaigns that go on that talk to the risks of getting infected, especially if you're pregnant. I just came back from Thailand. I was in Thailand last week up north where they've had Zika before, and big, huge posters saying, look out for these mosquitoes and look out for Zika, especially if you're a woman of childbearing potential or pregnant. And I have been to some meetings recently that have focused on Zika. So there is clearly attention coming back to Zika, that it is still a problem. It's still a problem that could explode at any moment. And we could run into the same issues we had a couple of years ago, because we still don't have a specific treatment for Zika. And we still don't have a vaccine that can protect people. So the work that's being done is some of the work that is occurring in the laboratory and animal studies and things of that nature.
This is Upstate's The Informed Patient Podcast. I'm your host, Amber Smith. I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Thomas. We talked about efforts to protect people from Zika virus, and now we're going to look at another mosquito-borne virus. So let's talk about the efforts to create a dengue vaccine. You wrote about this recently for Forbes magazine. Can you remind us about what the dengue virus is?
Sure. There are four different dengue viruses, dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4. They're similar in many ways, but they're distinct enough that they get a different name for each of them, and they kind of behave differently. They behave differently in nature. They behave differently in mosquitoes. They behave differently in people. And so we need to develop treatments and prophylactics like vaccines, for example, that can address each of the four different types of dengue virus. We have been trying to work on developing a dengue vaccine for almost a century. This started in the early 1900s, people understanding that dengue was a problem. We had had very large outbreaks of dengue in the United States. Back in the late 1700s, we had tens of thousands of people along the Delaware River in Philadelphia get infected. It was a known entity. And groups, especially the Department of Defense, because we had such a bad experience during World War II in the Pacific, the Department of Defense has been working on trying to create a dengue vaccine since the 50s. Matter of fact, Albert Sabin, who became very famous because of the oral polio vaccine, he was a young officer in the Army working on dengue long before he worked on polio, which is interesting. But there are three vaccines that really, in the last 10, 15 years, have either been licensed for use or they are in advanced clinical development. Sanofi Pasteur licensed the first vaccine, but the vaccine had a safety signal, especially in young children. The safety signal was in people that had never been infected with dengue before. When they got vaccinated, they had an increased risk of having a severe outcome if they did get infected after vaccination. And so it has a very limited indication in terms of who can get it and under what circumstances. And so, as I wrote in the piece, it's kind of died of market neglect. It just has not been picked up quite a bit. And then the most recent vaccine to be licensed was made by a Japanese pharmaceutical company called Takeda. And that does not have the same issues as Sanofi in terms of safety, but it does have issues of its own in that it works against dengue 1 and 2. It does not work against dengue 3. And we really don't know if it works against dengue 4. So even though I think my personal opinion is it can deliver a public health benefit, it's not going to be all things to all people. And then the third vaccine, which is in advanced development right now, is developed by the US NIH. And then it was licensed to a Brazilian company called Butantan. And it was also licensed to Merck, which is now MSD. And the company in Brazil, they're in the middle of a 5-year, very, very large trial, over 16,000 people. And the initial results from that are also positive in that it seems very safe. It seems to work against dengue 1 and 2. But we do not know if it works against dengue 3 or dengue 4 because there have not been enough dengue 3 or dengue 4 cases. So the study continues, and hopefully we'll have that information at some point. But I think this is going to be one of those things where these vaccines are going to be able to deliver clinical benefit, but it's not going to be all things to all people. We're going to have to manage our expectations, and we're going to have to not let great be the enemy of good and figure out how to best utilize these tools.
So it sounds like, as much as it would be ideal to have one vaccine that covered all four types of dengue, we may get four separate vaccines or fewer?
Yes. There are ministries of health and other public health authorities and regulatory authorities that make decisions of whether or not they're going to allow a country to license the vaccine and allow it to be marketed in that country. They're going to have to make risk-benefit determinations as long as they're safe, right? As long as they have proven that they can be safe, then they're going to have to think about, well, what viruses are most commonly being circulated in our community, or at least recently in our community, and which vaccine maybe is a better match for that. And then there's also going to be practical considerations of how many doses of the vaccine is there? What kind of vaccine construct is it? Can it be used in pregnant people? Can it be used in immunocompromised people? What's the cost of the vaccine? Like, all these kinds of things are going to play into it. The only vaccine that's been licensed in the United States is Sanofi's vaccine, but it can be used in very, very limited people. 9 to 16 years of age was the original approval. And you got to be tested before you can use it. The Takeda vaccine was under consideration by the FDA, but they pulled it from consideration after long discussions with the FDA, and at least what the company had in the lay press, that they were being asked for information that they weren't asked for previously. And so they didn't have that information. So they stopped pursuing a license in the US. They may come back, who knows? But we now have dengue, and we've had sporadically over the years dengue in the United States. So we've had outbreaks which have sickened hundreds of people in Key West and Hawaii. We've had sporadic cases in Southern California, Arizona, Texas. Last year alone, we had almost 180 cases of locally transmitted dengue in Florida. So if the susceptible people are there, if the mosquitoes are there, all you need is for the virus to be introduced and the fire can start and things can take off. So dengue countermeasures really need to be on the forefront of public health officials' mind for the United States, because it's not a matter of if, but when. And I can tell you, having seen firsthand Zika outbreaks and dengue outbreaks, they stress even the most advanced and well-resourced public health systems, and they can kill people. They kill about 40,000 people a year, mostly children. And so I think it's something we need to take seriously now at home.
Is there more than one type of dengue circulating in Florida? Like the cases from last year, were they all one type of dengue?
Typically, what you see is you either see a single type which predominates. Sometimes you see two types which predominate. You also have to distinguish, as you did, what is local versus what is travel related. Because if you look at travel related cases from 2010 to 2023 in the United States, we had over 10,000 travel related cases of dengue in the United States, which means 10,000 opportunities for a virus to be introduced into a new place. At some point, your number comes up, right? And it starts to be locally transmitted.
So does this spread from person to person?
No, it requires a mosquito. That's what happens the vast majority of the time. So for example, somebody goes on a cruise to the Caribbean, they go to Puerto Rico, they go wherever, they get infected, they come back home, the virus is replicating, they get off the plane, the mosquito feeds on them. Now the mosquito has virus in it, and then it goes to feed on another person. And as it's feeding on that person, the virus gets into that next person. And now that person's infected. And then another mosquito can come and feed on. And that's kind of the way that it plays out. There are some very, very rare circumstances, blood donation, organ donation, laboratory accidents, things of that nature. But it's most predominantly with mosquito to human to mosquito to human.
Are people ever screened for dengue or Zika when they're traveling to or from the U.S.?
No. Ideally, if you were going somewhere that dengue has circulated or Zika has circulated or any of the other viruses that we talk about, you'd go get a pre-travel consultation from a clinician and they would explain to you how to protect yourself and if there was a vaccine available or not, or if there were medications you could take, et cetera. And in the same way, if you came back and you were ill, I mean, I would highly encourage people, if you come back from a trip and you have a fever, if you come back from anywhere in the tropical or subtropical world and you have fever, you should go to see a physician because it could be something serious. And then during times when there are outbreaks, even if it's not in the US, if there are regional epidemics going on or certainly a pandemic going on, then the FDA or others may decide to screen the blood supply. They might do that at that time if it makes sense to do that. But no, it's not routine that people would be screened. It would just be part of whatever routine wellness checks they're doing at airports, then that's what they would do. And they don't do much of that now. They do it in other countries where they don't want these viruses to be introduced. They may have thermal cameras set up and things of that nature, but not in this country right now that I'm aware of.
So if somebody had dengue and survived and got well, are they protected from getting dengue again or any of the other types of dengue?
The good news is that the vast, vast majority of people who get infected, they're going to have a mild to moderate form of the disease. They're going to recover in about a week. They might have some prolonged period of fatigue and kind of the doldrums and not feel well for multiple weeks after that. But ultimately, everybody recovers. The vast majority of people recover. There are a small percentage of people who, if they have significant pre-existing medical problems, that they can do poorly and they can end up developing severe complications and die. What's interesting with dengue, though, is, and it's something unique about dengue, is the people who end up doing poorly are most of the time people who are getting infected a second time with a different virus than they got infected with the first time. And it's usually when the time span between that first infection and second infection is 18 months or more. They call these secondary infections. And so in people that have secondary infections, about 5% of them will develop severe disease. And severe disease is your blood vessels become leaky and fluid that's in the blood vessels leaks out of the blood vessels. You can have problems with coagulation. So you can start to hemorrhage internally, like in the GI tract, for example. You can get buildup of fluid in your chest or in your abdomen. And all of this can contribute to developing shock. And what shock is when your organs are not getting enough blood, they're not getting enough oxygen, and then they start to shut down and you go into something called multi-system organ failure. And that's what kills people. And that happens in about 5% of people that get these secondary infections. 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but they think on average, they estimate there's about 400 million people a year who get infected and about 100 million people a year who get sick. It's the denominator that matters when you're talking about the percentages. And so it does create, especially in low and middle income countries where dengue is endemic, it creates a huge resource issue and it can create a huge public health issue with hospitals just overflowing with patients during an epidemic. But in places that they know how to take care of dengue, the mortality rates can be less than 1%, well below 1%. But in places where they don't know how to take care of dengue, it can be as high as 20%, meaning one in five people will die. And unfortunately, in 2023, there were thousands and thousands of deaths. And in 2024, we're also seeing deaths already. A young person in the place I was in Thailand last week, a very young person had died of dengue. So it's a problem.
It sounds like you definitely don't want to get it if you can avoid it or try to avoid it.
You absolutely do. And to your question, once you get infected with, this is what we believe to be the case based on decades of research. Once you get infected with one dengue type, you should be immune to that dengue type, at least for decades. The dogma is for the rest of your life, but at least for decades, you should not be able to get infected with that type again. And so in places where there is a lot of dengue and where there are multiple types of dengue circulating over time, most people by the time they're 20, 25, they've already been infected twice. And we don't really see third infections or fourth infections that cause a problem, which kind of gives you targets in terms of a vaccine, of the bar you need to exceed to be able to protect somebody through their life and through vaccination, advance them beyond that window of risk.
So a vaccine would be one way to get at this. Is there any effort going into getting rid of the mosquitoes or making them where they can't transmit this?
They've tried a bunch of different ways to control the mosquitoes, to control how they breed. They've actually become quite well domesticated. They like to live in people's closets and in the houses and these kinds of things because they like to be near their food source. Spraying and all these other things, they just really haven't worked well. And they're really expensive and you need a lot of expertise and you need just tons of people to be able to consistently do this. And so even in places that are highly well-resourced and highly controlled, like Singapore, for example, where they can show that they actually make a dent in the mosquito population, it doesn't necessarily translate into less human disease. What has happened now, and there's a couple of groups that are taking different approaches, I'll just mention one of them, but there are these new innovative ways of trying to address mosquito populations. One of those ways is there is a bacteria that can infect mosquitoes. It's called Wolbachia. It can infect lots of different things, but it infects mosquitoes. It infects the mosquito that transmits dengue. And what they observed was that when the mosquito is infected with this bacteria, it cannot get infected with dengue virus. And these infected mosquitoes can overpopulate and push out uninfected mosquitoes. So what they have done is they have manufactured in these farms millions of infected mosquitoes that they can release then into these areas. They will outcompete the uninfected mosquitoes. And now the predominant mosquito species is unable to get infected and unable to transmit. And they've started doing those experiments and releases in different parts of the world over the last 5 years or so. The data is coming out and it's pretty compelling. And I think it could definitely be one of the tools, along with vaccination, for example, one of the tools in the toolbox to try to do something about this. I think there's other genetically modified mosquitoes and other approaches, but what I would say is they're innovative. There's potential there, and I'm very interested in seeing the information because it really seems like there's something there.
Well, considering climate change, do you think that there'll be any sort of a vaccine available before dengue becomes more of a problem in the United States than it is already?
Well, I think it already is a problem, to be honest with you. You don't even have to talk about climate change necessarily because just think of the ingredients. What do you need? You need mosquitoes, you need a virus, and you need susceptible people. So the vast majority of the population is susceptible because they've never been infected before. There are billions of travelers around the globe every single year, including the United States. So there's billions of opportunities to introduce viruses into the country. And the mosquito is here. And what makes the mosquito be able to be here is it's the right temperature, the right amount of moisture, and the right duration of the right temperature. And so if the temperature is going up and if weather patterns are changing, for whatever reason you believe they're changing, which we know that they are, then yeah, it creates this opportunity to establish dengue in the United States as an endemic disease like it was at one point in time. So I think the vaccine and the treatment discussion is now. It's not when the fire has gotten so far out of control. But again, maybe Takeda will come back to the FDA. I have no idea. And maybe Merck's development of the NIH vaccine, which I think all indicators are that it has the potential to be a very good vaccine. Maybe they'll push through licensure in the United States and we'll have an option. Even if it's not just here, it's an option for when you want to travel, when you want to go somewhere warm during the long Syracuse winters. Because more than one traveler has come back to Syracuse with more than just a souvenir and a t-shirt. They've come back sick and end up needing to see the doctor and turns out that they have dengue. That is not a rare event. It happens all the time.
Will the cold winters that we have in central New York, will that protect us from getting these mosquitoes that are carrying dengue?
Well, it doesn't get cold enough in many parts of the southern part of the country where the mosquitoes would dissipate. We do not have that mosquito up here. Different groups debate whether we do or we do not. I think the surveillance that the county has done over the last 10, 15, 20 years has shown that, or has failed to show that that mosquito is up here. We've got ticks. We've got other problems of our own. But again, as it gets warmer, as the winters get warmer, as the winters get shorter, then there is the possibility for these mosquitoes to persist for longer durations of time and for their offspring to survive the winter. But the ecology plays a lot into this. And as that changes, then the calculus for human disease changes as well.
Well, Dr. Thomas, once again, I appreciate you making time for this interview. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Dr. Stephen Thomas. He's professor and chair of microbiology and immunology at Upstate, and also the director of the Upstate Global Health Institute. The Informed Patient is a podcast covering health, science, and medicine, brought to you by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, and produced by Jim Howe. Find our archive of previous episodes at upstate.edu/inform. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend to listen too. And you can rate and review the Informed Patient podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. This is your host, Amber Smith, thanking you for listening.